This is the Careering into Motherhood podcast, and I'm Jane Johnson, founder of Careering into Motherhood. Through our coaching programs, masterclasses, the community of 7,000 women over on our Facebook group, and this podcast, we aim for a world where motherhood and ambition can happily coexist. For more information about all the support we offer, including coaching programs and masterclasses, please see our website, www.careeringintomotherhood.com, or find us on Facebook. Just look for the group Careering into Motherhood. My guest today is Catherine Birbal Singh, daughter of an Indo-Guyanese father and Jamaican mother. She came to the UK aged 15 and went into education. She is the founder of the Michaela Community School in Brent in North London, and rightly or wrongly, she has a reputation as a highly controversial head teacher for her views on discipline and educational reform. She's been accused of picking a fight with Stormzy by Stormzy himself, and has had death threats and trolls on a regular basis. Something I find incredibly alarming when you actually look at the context of a lot of what she says, and given the results she has with her pupils at her inner city school. I asked Catherine to come on the podcast as there are few things more talked about this month than education and the big return to school. I asked her about her career, what she's doing with the Michaela community, courting controversy and educating UK children in a post-pandemic world. This is what she had to say. I really can't remember, Catherine, how it came up. It must have been in a news feed somewhere. And then I started doing a bit more digging about the Michaela community and what you have set up there, which to me just seems absolutely awe-inspiring. So if you would, could you talk a little bit about how you came to set up the Michaela community and your career in education over the last, I think, 20 odd years?
Yes, well, I was normal teacher, became a head of department, became an assistant head, and then a deputy head. I was just working my way up to eventually becoming a head. I suppose I'd always had the dream of turning around a failing school. And I was always very dedicated to teaching, always worked in the inner city with disadvantaged children. It was my passion and my vocation. And I used to write an anonymous blog about various terrible situations that children would find themselves in and that teachers would find themselves in. And of course, no one knew who I was. I just used to write these stories when I'd get home and I'd think, gosh, I can't believe this. Life is dreadful, you know, and I'd write the blog. So, but what I didn't know at the time was that there were various people who were reading this blog, like Boris Johnson and Gove and people like this, you know. In those days, there was no Twitter. I would have conversations in the comments boxes underneath, you know, the blog. In any case, people started to see who I was. I mean, it's far more common that that happens nowadays. But in those days, I was one out of possibly two educational blogs out there. But I met someone who then introduced me to Michael Gove, who was education secretary at the time, because she just wanted me to tell him what was wrong with education. I had kind of frontline views of what was going on, and she interesting. So I met with him and I went along with my little list to tell him what he needed to fix. And I was a bit naive, didn't really think about it. You know, I thought I was being asked to tell him what was wrong. So that's what I did. He was obviously quite keen on having me at the political conference that they have once a year, which I didn't really know much about political conferences then. You know, I was too busy marking my books and teaching. I mean, I didn't know about politics.
And just for our listeners, can you talk a little bit about some of the things that you saw that you felt very strongly needed reforming?
Yeah, so I thought that we were giving children too many excuses, you know, this excuse culture. If it's not my fault, you know, I mean, I say, you know, about having anger management, for instance, you know, a child is labeled with having anger management. And it just means he goes around saying, I can be as horrible and as mean to you as I like. And I've got anger management, so it's okay, you know, that sort of thing, whatever it is. Oh, I'm black. Therefore, I don't have to do my homework because, you know, black children can't do homework. You know, this type of behavior, because we refuse to keep our standards high. That was one thing I spoke about. I spoke specifically about black kids being failed by white liberals. You know, this idea of so-called being nice. Well, actually, you're being mean to them because they're the ones that end up not being able to read when they leave school because you're not forcing them to do their homework or you're not getting them to turn up on time and so on.
But you had solutions for these, didn't you? So for our listeners who perhaps don't know so much about you and what you have done with the Michaela community and what you do generally in terms of, you know, that you are on their side. And I feel you often very much misquoted and put into the wrong kind of context, but you have solutions and proposals, don't you, to address those things?
Well, I don't just have proposals. I built a school and demonstrated many times over what you can do with children in your city. And it's not just the school here, my whole career. You know, I've had a lot of enemies. I tell you, if my enemies will have looked for children who felt they'd ever been let down by me, and they couldn't find a single one, you know? And that's because all of the children who have passed through my care over 20 years have benefited hugely from being in my care. Children like order and structure. It makes them feel safe. It means that when they're in the classroom, they feel safe to put their hand up and answer questions and to be ambitious without the culture of the street destroying their ambitions. Because the culture of the street, which infiltrates our schools, means that children, in particular young black boys, but it could be any number of children, who cannot allow themselves to want to be doctors and lawyers because the other children will look at them as if, well, they're a bit weird. Why would you want to be that when obviously, you know, a gangster lifestyle is far more interesting? You need to speak in a certain fashion. You need to walk in a certain fashion. All of those cultural elements that destroys these children's lives. It's really important to create an environment where they don't feel the pressure to be like that. And that requires a huge amount of order and structure around them. It means very high expectations when it comes to discipline. But if, as teachers, we say, well, actually, I feel bad because I'm quite privileged, I am, with my public school education and my parents who are still together and, you know, my very middle-class lifestyle, and I feel bad about that, whereas this boy, well, he's black and he lives on a council estate and he's, you know, he's only got a single mum, and so it's difficult for him. So me expecting him to do his homework is perhaps expecting too much of him. When you think like that, well, when they leave school, we've got 20% of our children leaving school who are functionally illiterate and functionally enumerate, and they think that they are oppressing children by putting them in detention. Well, I can tell you what oppresses those children. It's spending a lifetime not being able to read, spending a lifetime pretending that you know how to count your change in a shop when you really don't know how. These are well-meaning people who think they're doing the right thing by not holding their standards high for these children. It's hard to give a detention, much easier to say, don't worry about it, darling, I'll let you go this time. It makes you feel better about yourself. It's much harder to say, no, you're going to detention. And we do that here because we know what that does for these children. I mean, for our children, we were putting 2 grades on their GCSEs in terms of what they would have achieved had they been elsewhere, you know. We've got fantastic GCSE results. It's not just the GCSE results. It's also the kinds of children that they are. You know, somebody drops a plate in our canteen. You know, it isn't the case that all the kids start banging on the tables and screaming like wolves. That isn't what happens. Our children run to help that child pick up the plate that he's dropped. We want our children to work hard and to be kind. And those two things, I always say, if we manage to get every child in the school to leave school being able to do those two things, then we have succeeded.
But how is it that you have done that? Because the way you describe it, I mean, I appreciate it's a whistle-stop thing, but, you know, very, very focused on discipline and structure. And are you effectively saying that other schools who do not have this, that is the, you know, effectively that is their downfall, that is where they are failing their children? And how has it been so relatively easy for you to push this through at your school?
Well, it hasn't been easy. It's very hard, which is why most people wouldn't do it. You know, the fact is we're not the only school. I mean, there's other schools that have come before us that are very good on the discipline. I do think that we're the only school that has knowledge as our focus, and that in every classroom, knowledge is what is prized, and that we have traditional teaching methods in every single classroom. I don't think you'll find that anywhere else. But you will find good discipline elsewhere. You know, we have silent corridors. You'll find other schools with silent corridors. A very, very few. I mean, you can count them on one hand. There are 23,000 schools in this country, and you can count on one hand how many would have similar beliefs about discipline as we do. I do think that if you don't have that kind of discipline, and if you don't have the teachers being in a position of authority where they are leading the learning, that yes, you are letting the children down. Now, the more middle-class children will survive that because they'll be able to access learning at home. They sit around the dinner table and they talk about the politics of the day with their parents, and they read books with their parents and listen to Radio 4 and go to museums and art galleries and so on. So they know about the world. So the parents of a middle-class child make up for what the school doesn't do for them. Whereas the working-class child depends entirely on their school to be able to teach them. So at 11 years old, we've got children who come here with a reading age of a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old. You know, we have to rush through our corridors in silence so that we can get to our lessons quickly, so that we can spend all that time reading and learning, because otherwise those children will leave school illiterate. So either you want to weigh it up and you say, oh, but it seems really sad to have silent corridors. Well, I think it's more sad that that child will leave school illiterate. And you've got to make choices. With middle-class children, it's a lot easier, obviously, because, you know, in a more middle-class school, clearly you don't have children punching each other in the corridors. In the inner city, you do. You know, I mean, that's what we need to recognize. People think, oh, well, Catherine Birrell seems so mean. What would you prefer, to have children punching each other and slamming each other's heads in the walls and the corridors? I've known many children in my lifetime who train themselves never to go to the toilet all day because they know that the toilets are rife with bullying. We don't have any bullying here at Michaela. Everything is wonderful. The children are kind to each other and they grow up into decent human beings. I don't know why anyone would stand against what we're doing, but they have. And that's when you say, well, how come it was so easy? It wasn't easy at all. Still hard. We had people protesting outside. We had people infiltrating parents' evenings, shouting abuse at me, sending me racist emails. I've had death threats. I mean, you cannot imagine what I have been through to make this school succeed. I used to say, you'd think we were building nuclear bombs.
Like, yeah.
All we're doing is setting up a school in the inner city to help disadvantaged children.
But so why do you think there is this controversy around what you are doing? Because if I take exactly as you've described what you say, you know, number, I suppose there are two questions that come to my mind. One is, how do you get children to have this sort of love of learning, which is what you're describing, that the kids want to get to lessons because they want to learn. And yet other schools, they don't have that.
Children will adapt to the culture that they're in. And if your culture is one of everybody just do what you like, you're all free, you know, let's just have fun. Actually, you can have your mobile phones out at break. Some schools can use them in the classroom. I mean, obviously, if you have your phone on all the time, children are going to be on Snapchat. I mean, why would they be doing otherwise? They're children. You obviously don't allow phones, so they're not distracted in that kind of way.
And you've spoken quite a lot on digital influence on kids, haven't you? I'd like to just unpick that a little bit, because I thought it was a brilliant speech where you were talking about schools, certainly in the state system, where they have tens of whiteboards and they're teaching kids via technology, et cetera, et cetera. And you go into the private system, I think you cited Eton. I have never been to Eton, but where they have one digital whiteboard, and you had a lot to say about that, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, I mean, isn't it interesting? We'll say, oh, these children are so privileged, and yet it's the children in the state sector who have these interactive whiteboards. Now, I have to say the state sector has finally realized that interactive whiteboards are silly, but this is after billions was spent on interactive whiteboards, putting them in every classroom in every school, and they were an utter waste of money. I remember being told that if you use your interactive whiteboard, you will increase your GCSE grades by one. So if a child was meant to get a B, he will get an A if you use an interactive whiteboard. And at the time, I questioned it and said, but how the hell is that possible? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. But the thing is, this is what happens in education all the time. Things that are plainly nonsensical are pushed down teachers' throats. And the thing is, teachers who have been doing this for years, they know, oh, this is just the latest fad, right? We'll just ignore that and I'll just get on with what I know works. And ultimately, that's what tradition is about in the classroom. And I'm a traditional teacher and I believe in traditional methods because they've worked for hundreds of years. It's only in the last 30 or 40 years that we've changed things. So we're trying to pull education back towards the traditional. I think we've managed to do it in a big way. I mean, if in 2007, 2008, 2009, there's no way anyone would be having the conversations that they have now about knowledge versus skills. I mean, knowledge wasn't even talked about in those days. All anybody thought teaching was simply teaching children skills, and that was it. Now people understand they need to know stuff. I mean, it is extraordinary, actually, what's happened in the last decade and how much further ahead we are now in education than we were then. And it's wonderful to be part of that revolution, to have made our mark and contributed, and we continue to contribute. And we get over 600 visitors a day who come to visit us here. Mainly teachers from across the world, but mainly from Britain. And they take ideas and they go back to their schools and they change things for the better. And I'm thrilled, really, that that's the case, because we make a difference to the children here. but we also transform things for children outside of our building. And that's a wonderful thing.
Did you always have this vision of creating something like this from when you, you know, you, as you said, you started in inner city schools and wanted to, wanted to improve things for the kids there? Did you know this could be created?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I'd always done things well in my classroom. And then when I ran a department, I took over a failing department and I turned it around and changed it all up so that all of those kids in that department were doing really well. And then when I became an assistant head, I put in behavior policies in the school that affected the entire school. And we went from having fights constantly, both in the corridors and in the classrooms, to having no fights at all. You know, so I had been having impact across my career, but just not across an entire school. Although I say that when I was in senior teams, I did have impact across school, but not as much as I've, say, had with Michaela, because it's not just school here, it's also outside the school that we have influenced education. What's great about free schools is that I've been able to gather together like-minded people who are able to deliver a similar type of teaching, you know, leading from the front, recognizing that we are in authority as adults and as teachers, and the children are in our care, and that it's our job to look after them because we love them. We're not just going to let them free to do whatever they want, because if they do what they want, well, they'll listen to Stormzy and read Snapchat, they'll hang out with their friends as opposed to doing their algebra. You know, we need to lead them. That's our job. And yes, I do feel that schools and parents let their children down when they allow children to lead. Children are not meant to lead. We are meant to look after them.
Yeah, and I've heard you talk in, you know, you're obviously a big believer in leaders. What makes a leader in your eyes, and what is their role in a school society?
Well, you've got to have a vision of what you want. And you asked me earlier, actually, did I know that this existed? I knew it could be better, that we could do things differently. And what we did was we looked at the details. Are they going to have a bag? Where is their bag going to go? How are we going to stand in the classroom? How are the desks going to be put? Where are we putting the bins? You know, the tiniest of details. And we fixed those details and we kept on fixing, because sometimes we change our minds. You try something, it doesn't work. You change your mind, do something else. And over time, what happened was this school became Michaela and it was created. And even I, you know, sometimes I wander through the school and I think, wow, it is just amazing. I mean, I really am surprised myself, because it is what my teachers are doing in their classrooms and how the learning is just so extraordinary. And teachers from around the world are always amazed at how much our children know, how articulate they are, how independent and creative they are. They just can't believe it. So it's just really exciting. And of course, it takes somebody at the top to have a vision. Then you need to know how to deliver that vision to the people who work for you so that they are then communicating. So I could be out of this school for a couple of weeks and you wouldn't notice a difference. It would run just as it is. And I think that's really important as a leader. You should always run your organization as if you weren't there. Because if it requires you marching around the school and going, right, look at me, I'm in charge, etc., then they're too dependent on you. You've got to develop your staff so that they can exist without you and they can live without you. So you are developing your senior leaders to do that role. Then you've got your middle leaders who are developing in a middle leadership way. And so that in the end, you can stand back and kind of watch it just work. And that is currently kind of what I do, really. I mean, I meet with my senior team every morning and I'm making judgment calls constantly. But I'm not in the classrooms. You know, in fact, I always feel slightly awkward about, you know, being in a teacher's classroom because I know how worried and it's just disconcerting for them, isn't it? So I don't really go in the classrooms. I think people have an image of me as I'm obviously some kind of tyrant who marches around.
Buccaneer warlord is how I read one description of you, Catherine.
and that's true when it comes to the system, when it comes to breaking down and what's going on outside. In school, I mean, I leave my teachers alone and they get on with things. I give them lots of freedom within the context of being Michaela. And because they are all very Michaela and they believe in what we're doing here, they're all able to deliver. And I trust them. You know, I trust them to deliver what I think is right. And so I don't have to be in their classrooms at all. And I never am. You know, I remember a year seven boy once, I sat next to him, it was years ago, but I sat next to him at lunch and he just arrived. And he said, "Miss, you're the headmistress, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." I said, oh, it doesn't feel like you're the headmistress.
Really?
And I said, why is that? Is it because I'm not in the yard telling everybody how to stand and where to go? And I said, yeah, I can see why you think that. But trust me, I'm the headmistress.
Yeah, but he didn't need to ask again. And I want to come on to talk a little bit about the pandemic and the impact it's had. Particularly, it occurred to me, I saw a video when I was researching for this interview. I saw a video on YouTube of lunchtime in your canteen, your school lunchtimes, where, well, you are obviously far better placed to explain it than I do, but people were standing up, giving a gratitude statement to somebody on their table or somebody in their lives. There was a quick two claps. They sat down and somebody else stood up. And I mean, I have to be honest, Catherine, it struck me as something that would not be out of place in China or Korea, but it was admirable. It was hugely admirable. Now, with the pandemic, that's one thing that I can imagine has been impacted. But also, how are you ensuring that all of the great work that you are doing is not undone if these kids can't come into school and are from families where education is perhaps not prioritized?
Well, they are coming in, actually, we're finding. They are, for the most part, coming in, and we're getting them in. I mean, obviously, over lockdown period, it was devastating for disadvantaged families because, you know, they're not able to try and catch up with tutors, and they're not able to, you know, they don't have the help from their parents at home. And obviously, we were setting loads of work, and we were doing video lessons. We were doing a whole load of stuff. I mean, my teachers were extraordinary. But the thing is that you can't hold them to account for their learning. And a teacher who is a good teacher is always checking for understanding, checking to see whether or not they've actually learned this stuff and remembered it. You can't do that if they're at home. You know, it's impossible. So we're having to play catch up now to a certain extent. But that's all anyone can do. And at least here, we've got the right type of teaching methods to make sure children will catch up. What worries me elsewhere is that if they're not doing that, and that's not everywhere, because as I say, a lot of this stuff on knowledge has become much more popular in the last 10 years. So there are schools, that other schools like ours, that are doing that. But I wouldn't say they were the majority. And I do worry about those children in schools where they're still using progressive teaching methods, because if ever there were a time where we need to teach the children properly, it's now. So that is hard. But at Michaela, it's been a bit easier, I think, than it is at other schools, because we were already very COVID-friendly because we already got all the kids. You know, it's already the case that they are only in year groups for break time and lunchtime and separately. It's already the case that we walk in silence in the corridors. It's already the case that they walk in single file looking at the head in front of them. And so all of this stuff that we've done not naturally, well, means that in terms of COVID, they're a lot safer, you know?
Yeah. And I think you were quite outspoken on when there was talk about, you know, children wearing masks or not, weren't you?
Well, what I can't stand is the dishonesty. They're going to have masks in corridors, but they're not going to have it in lessons where they're all doing group work and pair work. I mean, none of it makes any sense. Oh, they don't talk in classrooms, but they do in corridors. No, actually, I think you'll find in most schools, they're all chatting away in classrooms. It's just the nonsense. And I mean, I sort of understand why the government have done that. You know, they need to appease the unions and they need to make people feel like they've allowed something. And I think they made the right call, which is to leave it up to schools, and the school will decide what they think is right. You know, we don't speak in the corridor, so why would we have masks? It doesn't make any sense.
And I can't not ask you about this A-level fiasco or scandal, let's say, that occurred this year. What are your thoughts? You have obviously been, you know, you are very political and involved in politics. What do you think is going to be the long-term impact of this, whether it's in politics or also on children going into, or kids going into university now?
Well, I understand the universities have been very generous and have taken in most children. So in the end, I think it sort of worked out. I mean, it was obviously a total disaster. And similarly at GCSE, it was a disaster. And in the end, we had to go with teacher assessment. And what it's demonstrated once and for all is that obviously teacher assessment is inherently flawed. Flawed because you cannot get consistency across the country. And it's not because teachers are stupid or they're deliberately doing things incorrectly. It's just that consistency is impossible across the country. And some teachers are super optimistic and some teachers are more pessimistic. And that's because sometimes when you go into an exam, you just have a good day. You know, you just go in and for whatever reason, the kid has a good day and they really surprise you. sometimes an ideal paper comes up. Every time there's an exam paper, teachers run in, they look at the paper. Did the questions come up? Yes, we got the questions we wanted. You know, like that's just the nature of an exam. So those teachers who think, well, if the questions I want come up, I'm going to give them an A or predict a 9, you know. The questions that come up that aren't the questions I want, well, then I'll be predicting them a 5, you know. You need an exam. It's the only way of making it objective and fair across the country. And it's not because teachers do anything wrong. You know, I mean, you had one group of people who were saying teacher assessment is obviously the way to go. Teachers are perfect. And then there was this other group of people who were saying, no, teachers are all biased and they just do this. They give them better results than they should be getting because they want to make themselves look good. And like, no, neither of those camps is correct. Teachers are human and they're flawed. And that's why we need to have exams every year. And I suspect now forevermore, we will always have exams. And that's a good thing. Mm.
Okay, thank you. And just final question. You've talked about, well, you touched upon Stormzy, and I know you've had a lot of controversy throughout your career. I guess, do you ever just get exhausted by it and think, I've done all I can here? Michaela community is absolutely firing on all cylinders. Time to shut up shop and retire off into the sunset.
Yes, every day.
Do you? I thought you were going to say no. No way.
It's a big joke. I say to the staff that we're building a rocket on the roof of the school, and that I will be getting into it at some point and flying to Mars.
They'll still find you.
I mean, every day, because it's absolutely exhausting. Exhausting fighting with everyone all the time. It's I mean, we don't fight with each other here in the school. This is a wonderful oasis. I'm so grateful for this school. I love coming in here. I love working with the staff. I love the children. And it's just a wonderful place to be. And actually, over lockdown, it was quite hard for many of us being away from school because we so love being here. So yeah, I'm very grateful for the school. It's just that outside, I'm having to constantly fight with everyone. And the thing is that I'm saying things that I think are perfectly commonsensical. I think actually a lot of people agree with me. I know this because I get DMs on Twitter. I get people telling me this, whispering into my ear at conferences and things. And they say to me, so happy that you're saying what you're saying, Catherine. Please continue. I don't tell anyone my name. They're terrified. So they don't want anyone to know that they think so. But I know that the majority of people out there are on our side. And I know that what we're doing is good. And I suppose I see it as my duty. I feel that this is what I need to do to be able to look back on my life when I'm 85 on my deathbed, say, I lived a good life. I did something. I had impact. I changed the world for the better. And yes, I would prefer to go off into the sunset and sit on some beach, but I don't know. I suppose maybe I'd get a bit bored. I do wish that the vitriol was, you know, less, but, you know, I mean, nobody likes to be hated, you know, I mean, but the fact is, that's my role. I've got to do it, you know, because otherwise I won't be able to look back at my life and say I did something, you know?
Whether you agree with Catherine Burwell-Singh's approach to educational reform or not, there is no doubt that she is passionate, driven by self-belief, and is clearly getting results. After the interview, she actually invited me to go to the school one day and see for myself what they're doing there. I have to say, I would love to. And personally, I would have loved the opportunity to have gone to a school where an overriding focus on knowledge as a lever to my future was placed above and beyond anything else. My thanks to Catherine for coming on the show at such an incredibly busy time. You can find out more about Careering into Motherhood at www.careeringintomotherhood.com. I will see you again in the next couple of weeks.